All right, it's great to be here. So when I say gamma ray bursts throughout this talk, I'm really gonna refer to long duration gamma ray bursts that are associated with core collapse supernovae empirically. And I think the two plausible ideas that have been put forward as to how you can get a gamma ray burst, a highly relativistic explosion in the context of core collapse supernovae, is one that you form a black hole with an accretion disk around it. That black hole generates a jet which powers through the star, giving you eventually, through processes we don't understand very well at large distances, a gamma ray burst. That's the collapsar model. And the other possibility is that you form a very rapidly rotating neutron star, strongly magnetized, rapidly rotating neutron star. And that neutron star, that the strong magnetic field of the neutron star extracts some reasonable fraction of the rotational energy of the neutron star in 10 or 30 seconds, spinning down the neutron star and powering an explosion. And it's that scenario that I'm gonna talk about. So I think the two clauses that really should be here, but it makes for an overly long title, is long duration gamma ray bursts from the birth of some magnetars. It's pretty clear that not all magnetar births would be associated with long duration gamma ray bursts just from rate arguments and other considerations, but there may be a small subset of them that do produce gamma ray bursts, or also perhaps, as I'll talk about, hyperenergetic supernovae. So this work is a series of projects that started out with basically analytical estimates and has become slightly more sophisticated using some numerical simulations. The simulations in particular are done by Niccolo Bucchiantini, who's a Hubble fellow now at Berkeley. So the three collaborators in yellow are the three most important collaborators on this project. That includes me being in white. Those are Niccolo, Brian Metzger, who's a student of mine, and Todd Thompson, who was a Hubble fellow at Berkeley and is now a postdoc in Princeton. So let me just give you a sense of what I want to talk about. So I'm going to give a very brief motivation. I'm not really going to talk about observations of GRBs or the connection to core collapse supernovae, which has been a very important observational breakthrough in the past 5 years or so. I do want to briefly motivate the whole idea of rapidly rotating strongly magnetized neutron stars by talking a little bit about the diversity of young neutron stars and the idea of where some of that diversity might come from. But really, the bulk of the talk is going to focus on trying to answer the basic questions that you would like to answer if you want to understand how you can have a source producing a gamma ray burst, namely, what sets in the context of a young neutron star with a strong magnetic field, what sets the rate at which it loses energy, mass, and how relativistic the outflow is. And really, this is in the first 1,000 seconds of the life of the neutron star, because that's the time scale of interest for long duration gamma ray bursts. And then the second question that I'm gonna address, which I think is equally important, is how can one account for the observed collimation, the fact that the relativistic outflows in gamma ray bursts are inferred observationally to be collimated. So it's not a spherical relativistic explosion, it's a collimated relativistic explosion. And I'll talk briefly about the observational case for that. So how can one get the observed collimation? And I'll try to make a case that that may come not as an intrinsic property of the outflow from the neutron star, but rather via interaction with the surrounding progenitor star. And this being the KITP, this is a relatively theoretical talk, so there's not going to be a lot of GRB phenomenology. And what I really want to do is try to understand how we can use our understanding of the physics of the central engine to connect to these basic theoretical questions: mass loss, energy loss rate, collimation, how relativistic the outflow is. And the goal, right, as an empirical problem, the goal is to get 10 to the 51, maybe 10 to the 52 ergs of energy out in 10 to 100 seconds in material that's moving at actually a variety of Lorentz factors, from maybe non-relativistic, that's the hyperenergetic supernovae associated with gamma ray bursts that we measure, to material moving at Lorentz factors above 30 or so that can give rise to the gamma ray burst. So, just to set the stage for this, we know now of a wide variety of observational manifestations of young neutron stars. The kind of classic picture is rotation-powered pulsars like the CRAB. This is the beautiful Chandra X-ray image of the central part of the CRAB nebula, I'll come back to that a little bit later. We think through a variety of population studies that typical radio pulsars are born with magnetic fields of order 10 to the 12 Gauss, rotation periods of 50 milliseconds or so. In addition to rotation-powered pulsars, there's also a class of young neutron stars that appear to be just thermally emitting objects. This is one example. This is an X-ray image, and this is an optical image where you're seeing the residual heat from when the neutron star was formed. And then finally, the class of young neutron stars that's really of most relevance to this talk is magnetars. So there's very good empirical evidence now that a subset of neutron stars, the estimates of the birth rate are in the 10% range, maybe tens of percent of neutron stars, are born with magnetic fields ranging from 10 to the 14 to 10 to the 15 Gauss. And there are a number of independent observational and theoretical arguments for that. Directly, we see spin down of the neutron star. You measure the period, you measure the rate of change of the period. By standard dipole arguments, you infer the magnetic field strength, and that gives 10 to the 14, 10 to the 15 Gauss. The flares, this is an example of the very dramatic December O flare from Sag 1806. These flares are super Eddington, and one explanation for that is that the magnetic field changes the opacity, the very strong magnetic field, allowing you to have a long-lived super Eddington flare. And the quiescent flux that we see from magnetars is much larger than the spin-down power, the current spin-down power of the magnetar, suggesting there's another energy source powering the quiescent emission that we see, and the natural candidate for that that emission is the magnetic field, so magnetic field decay. So again, the estimate of the rates is that about 10% of neutron stars, the birth rate, relative to the birth rate of standard radio pulsars, CRAB isn't exactly standard, but relative to the birth rate of radio pulsars, magnetars might have a birth rate of about 10% of that. And that is then a reasonable fraction of all neutron stars then is born with magnetic fields of 10 to the 14 to 10 to the 15 Gauss. And so the natural question is, why do we have this dichotomy? Why, or it may be a continuum, we don't really know. Why are some neutron stars born with very strong magnetic fields? Why are some neutron stars born with much weaker magnetic fields? And one suggestion in a really beautiful series of papers that really predicted the existence of magnetars is that this difference has to do with the rotation of the neutron star that's formed. So clearly, this difference has to be tied to some difference in the progenitors or in the physics of the supernova mechanism that gives rise, in some cases, to strongly magnetize, some cases to weakly magnetize. And what Chris Thompson and Rob Duncan did in the early 1990s is they made the observation that if you go through the stages of stellar evolution and you ask which stage of stellar evolution appears to be the most efficient for generating neutron star magnetic fields, that in fact the dynamo in the first 10, 30 seconds of the neutron star's life, a convective dynamo in the very early phases of the neutron star's life, appears to be the most efficient time in the entire evolution of the neutron star for generating the magnetic field. And if that's true, they argued, then the large-scale dipole magnetic field that you get out of that dynamo in the first 10 seconds of the neutron star's life will depend on the rotation of the neutron star. And the argument is as follows. We know that if I have convection, I can easily get magnetic energy comparable to the energy in the convective motions. But the problem is that energy tends to be on very small scales. What you want to get a magnetar is you want a big dipole field. And the argument they made is that you can get a big dipole field when the rotation period of the neutron star is comparable to the time scale for convective motions to go around at eddy turnover time, which requires periods of order a millisecond. So this is a conjecture. I mean, this is a theoretical argument at this point. I would say we don't have observational evidence for it, right? It's important to remember that magnetars don't have millisecond periods now. They have periods of 7 seconds. The reason for that, we think, is that they spin down very fast. The standard estimate is if you start at a millisecond, you'll get to 5 to 10 seconds in 10 to the 4 years. I'll argue you might even get there faster in some cases when the neutron star is born rapidly rotating. So this is a theoretical argument. There is a little bit of support for it from numerical simulations. This is a a set of simulations that was done actually for understanding planetary dynamos. And what this shows is F dipole here is the fraction of energy in the dipole component relative to all of the higher order small scale magnetic field as a function basically of the rotation rate of the neutron star. This is the Rossby number for those who are interested in this. So this is rapid rotating neutrons. In our picture, this would be rapid rotating neutron stars. This would be slowly rotating neutron stars. And what this set of simulations done to understand planetary dynamo shows is that indeed, the rapid rotators tend to have a very large fraction of the total magnetic energy in the large scale component, while the slow rotators have much less of the energy in the large scale component. It's mostly tied up in these small scale, high dipole moments. So this is some numerical support for this conjecture, but it is important to emphasize that at this point, this is just a theoretical argument. We don't have any particular observational evidence for it, except perhaps for gamma ray bursts. So what I'd like to do is to explore a little bit this hypothesis, namely, what is the physics of a very rapidly rotating, strongly magnetized neutron star? If a subset of neutron stars are born with these properties, how does the neutron star spin down? What is its impact on its host star? Can you get a gamma ray burst? Can you get a hyperenergetic supernova? So I'm not going to go through all of this, but I just want to explain a little bit about where the story I'm going to tell you starts. So this is a kind of standard slide from Attenborough showing the various evolutionary paths to core collapse supernova. You collapse, you somehow explode, and then you're left with a neutron star that's radiating away its gravitational binding energy in neutrinos. Okay. And it's contracting on a Kelvin-Helmholtz time scale, which is of order a few seconds to 10 seconds. And so the arguments I'm going to give are really starting here. So I'm going to assume that this part of the chain has been completed, that we've actually been able at some level to blow up the star, and we're left with this neutron star that's rapidly rotating, strongly magnetized, spinning down. And of course, since we don't understand in detail the explosion mechanism, that's really why I wanted to emphasize that this is my starting point. I do think that this is plausible, that in fact, in the case of a rapidly rotating neutron star, you have an additional source of energy to drive the supernova explosion. And that energy is, of course, the rotational energy of the neutron star. The rotational energy of a neutron star is a few by 10 to the 52 seconds for a millisecond rotator. That's an energy scale which is large compared to the energy of a canonical supernova. And that energy, generically, what happens if I take a core of a massive star and I collapse it, I end up with a differentially rotating newly formed neutron star, and that's shown here in some calculations that Todd Thompson, Adam Burrows, and I did. So this is just the rotation of the neutron star. This is the differential rotation, the shear of the neutron star. And this energy and all of this differential rotation can actually be tapped to drive the supernova explosion. One realization of that is some calculations here by Adam Burrows and collaborators, which actually goes back to work by LeBlanc and Wilson. What this is you start off with a core that is going to form a millisecond rotator and it has a strong magnetic field. As the core collapses, you generate this differential rotation, you wind up the magnetic field, and that powers a jet out through the collapsing star, driving an explosion. So in this case, what you're basically seeing, this is magnetic pressure over gas pressure, illustrating that along the axis here, you have strong magnetic fields, you have outflowing material, you still have some inflowing material in the equatorial plane, but you have a strong explosion initiated along the poles. So if you were to ask me, do I actually believe this calculation, I believe the results of the calculation. I don't believe necessarily the assumptions that go into it, because a key assumption in this particular calculation is that I have a very large scale, strong magnetic field to start with. That on collapse already gives you, by flux freezing, 10 to the 14, 10 to the 15 Gauss. And that assumption may well not be correct. It may be that you have to wait a while to get a dynamo to get the strong magnetic field. But generically, it seems to me that the assumption that we have a successful explosion is particularly plausible in the case of a rapidly rotating neutron star where you have additional sources of energy to tap into to drive the explosion. And so that's really going to be my starting point, is that we've exploded the star and we've left behind now, and left behind means, you know, a second later, not that much longer later, we've left behind a newly formed, strongly magnetized, rapidly rotating neutron star. So the standard estimate of what happens given the birth of such a neutron star is that we can basically just take the theory of how pulsars lose their energy, which is to a magnetic wind, a relativistic outflow, vacuum dipole radiation, and we can estimate the rate at which the neutron star will lose energy and how long it will take the neutron star to lose all of its energy, given an initial field of 10 to the 15 Gauss, say, in a period of a millisecond. This standard vacuum dipole estimate is that the neutron star loses energy at a prodigious rate, 10 to the 49 ergs a second, and it spins down on a time scale of something like an hour. And so this led a number of people, Usov, Rob Duncan, Chris Thompson, and others, to suggest that such a strongly magnetized millisecond magnetar would be a natural candidate for producing long duration gamma ray bursts. To get the time scale right, maybe you need a field of 10 to the 16 Gauss, 3 by 10 to the 15 Gauss. To get a spin down time scale, to get a sufficient amount of energy out in 10 seconds to 30 seconds. So what I want to argue is that, in fact, in the first 10 to 100 seconds in the life of a neutron star, the fact that you still have neutrino radiation leaving the neutron star, it's cooling down, radiating 10 to the 53 ergs in neutrino radiation, that actually modifies quite substantially how the neutron star spins down. And in particular, what happens is that as the neutrinos leave the surface of the neutron star, some of their energy is deposited into the atmosphere of the neutron star, and it blows material away from the neutron star. This is a neutrino-driven wind. And so you have actually very, very large mass loss rates from the surface of the neutron star in the first 10 or 30 seconds, the timescales we care about, because of the continuous loss of energy by neutrinos. And large mass loss rates means, as I'll show in a little bit, 10 to minus 3 solar masses a second, right? Very, very, very large mass loss rates from the surface of the neutron star.
What is spin down time assume?
So this is the aligned dipole value. So there's been some really beautiful work on force-free calculations of this by Anatoly Spitkovsky just in the past year or two, which shows that there's about a factor of 2 difference between aligned and 90 degrees. So there's a factor of 2 uncertainty in this from the angle. The effects I'll talk about are actually much larger than that. But that's right. So this strong mass loss in the early phase of the neutron star has to be considered. It modifies how the neutron star spins down. And in particular, if you're a GRB person, and if you want to get a GRB out of this newly formed neutron star, then this mass loss is absolutely critical to understanding how relativistic the outflow is. This tells you how much energy is coming out, but the mass loss tells you the Lorentz factor of that material. And so understanding the spin down in the presence of strong mass loss is quite important for understanding how relativistic the flow is. Okay. So let me set up the picture for a series of calculations. This is a simulation, actually a general relativistic simulation, of a dipole, a rotating neutron star with a dipole magnetic field and a aligned dipole. Okay. So the rotation axis and the magnetic moment axis are aligned. This is done by Niccolo Bucchiantini. I'll talk about this a little bit more later, these particular simulations. What I want to do now is just kind of set up the picture of how the neutron star spins down and how it loses mass. So what is shown here are magnetic field lines. These are the poloidal magnetic field lines. And then this color scale is the toroidal field, so the field in the phi direction. So when this is small near the surface of the neutron star, means you basically have radial field lines coming off of the neutron star surface. And at larger distances, the field gets wrapped up in the angular direction by the rotation of the neutron star. So this is the size of the neutron star here, and this is distance in units of neutron star from 1 to 10 neutron star radii. There's a region in the equatorial plane close to the neutron star where the field lines are closed, right? You notice all of these field lines open up. Okay, these field lines are closed. This is exactly the same as the sun. If you look at the structure of the solar magnetic field, near the equatorial plane you have closed magnetic field lines, along polar regions you have open magnetic field lines, and the material flows out, mass can flow out along the open magnetic field lines. So what happens is you get outflow along these open magnetic field lines. The material, initially as it's flowing out, the magnetic field is so strong that the material just co-rotates like this along with the magnetic field of the neutron star. So the gas that's flowing out actually gains angular momentum from the magnetic field. And eventually you get to a distance, this is called the Alfvén radius, where the magnetic energy is comparable to the kinetic energy in the outflow. And at that point, the material can no longer rotate rigidly, but the field lines get bent back, get swept back by the inertia of the material. And so what happens is that along these field lines, you extract a huge amount of angular momentum from the neutron star. If you lose a certain amount of mass, m dot, the rate at which you lose angular momentum is not determined by what's the angular momentum of material at the surface of the neutron star. It's determined by what's the angular momentum of the material at this Alfvén radius. So that this is basically the reason why you can get efficient spin down of a central object in the presence of magnetic fields, this enhanced torque due to the strong magnetic field, and associated with losing more angular momentum is also losing more energy. So where is this Alfvén radius located? Well, if I'm losing a tremendous amount of mass from the surface of the neutron star, then the magnetic field is actually irrelevant. Okay. And this Alfvén radius would move all the way into the surface of the neutron star. As the mass loss decreases, think of the neutron star cooling, the mass loss decreases, that Alfvén radius actually moves out, okay? And it moves out as far as it can, and in a relativistic problem, it moves out to the light cylinder, which is the location where you co-rotating would be moving at the speed of light. The Alfvén radius can't move past the light cylinder, or else material would be rotating faster than the speed of light. So this really sets the relevant scales in the problem that determines how efficiently the neutron star spins down. Where is this region of co-rotation? Where is the light cylinder of the neutron star? How much mass is flowing out along these open magnetic field lines? How big is this region where there is no open field lines, where the field lines are closed? These are the questions you have to understand how the neutron star spins down. And it really is very much analogous to understanding how the sun loses its angular momentum, with one difference in the case of the sun, we don't care about the light cylinder. The sun is not a relativistic object. Yep?
In the time scale you showed before,
yep, correct. So the time scale, that's very important. The time scale I showed before is assuming that there's basically no mass flux, and it's purely an electromagnetic torque due to the rotating neutron star. In that case, the Alfvén radius equals the light cylinder, and the reason that the torque is then determined by the fact that you can't co-rotate outside the light cylinder. That sweeps back the magnetic field. That's right. So that's the limit that the mass loss goes to zero. And there's another approximation there that I'll talk about in a second. Okay. So to solve this problem, then all you need to do, right, is you need to put on a computer all the neutrino microphysics, solve for this relativistic outflow from the neutron star. That will tell you how the neutron star spins down. So that's a complicated problem, so we decided to break this problem up into two pieces. So the two pieces are, the first thing we did is let's just solve for the structure of the outflow along one of these sets of field lines. Let's make it a one-dimensional problem where we're just solving for what happens here, okay? And we're including all of the neutrino physics that's blowing mass off the surface. Once we know the rate at which you're blowing mass off the surface, then we can go back and understand this two-dimensional structure, okay? Using simulations that have the correct mass loss rate, but none of the neutrino physics. The neutrino physics of the early neutron star really only matters in setting how much mass is being lost. Once you know how much mass is being blown off the surface, the rest of the problem you can treat as a problem with essentially no neutrino physics and a given m dot and knowing the magnetic field structure. So that's the way we approach this problem. First, calculate the mass loss rate in the simple model where it's a one-dimensional problem, and then use that in the two-dimensional context to understand the spin down.
Are you sensitive to the radius of the last closed field
line? Wait.
Okay.
Yes. That's actually one of the particularly interesting things. All right, so the one-dimensional problem, this is a standard problem, it's known as the Weber-Davis problem. This is basically the classic problem in understanding the spin down of any rotating magnetized object, jets from black holes, rotating stars. So the problem is, you just solve in this one-dimensional flux tube, you solve for an outflow from a rotating central object. So it's 1D, you include the neutrino physics at the surface of the star that's blowing the mass off. That allows you to calculate the mass loss rate, m dot. And you also get the energy loss rate and the angular momentum loss rate because you can calculate where this point of co-rotation is. So this was work done with my student Brian Metzger. And the way this calculation works is, if I'm given, say, the magnetic field strength, the rotation rate of the neutron star, and the neutrino luminosity, which is blowing the material off the surface of the neutron star, you can calculate mass loss, energy loss, angular momentum loss in this 1D problem. The most important thing here is actually the mass loss rate, because we're really going to get the energy loss rate from the two-dimensional problem once we know the one-dimensional problem. So this is a plot showing mass loss rate as a function of rotation frequency of the neutron star. So the periods we care about from the point of view of gamma ray bursts and hyperenergetic supernovae are millisecond, just because that's the energy scale of the problem. So this is the scale that matters. And what's shown is mass loss rate as a function of angular frequency for a couple different magnetic field strengths and for different times, where time here really means neutrino luminosity. So what we've done is we've taken a model of how neutron stars cool, and at about 1 second, you know what the neutrino luminosity is. That's the solid lines. You can calculate the mass loss rate. At 2 seconds, the neutron star neutrino luminosity has dropped dramatically, and so the mass loss rate drops dramatically.
When you are saying 1D, you mean cylindrical symmetry?
Spherical. So this is a spherical symmetry. That's right.
The point on the far left is would be the old result, m dot on the neutrino.
Yes. So these points are consistent with a bunch of calculations that people have done in the literature for non-rotating, non-magnetized neutron stars. And what you see here is that the presence of rapid rotation and a strong magnetic field dramatically increases the mass loss rate. The mass loss rate actually goes up exponentially with the rotation rate of the neutron star. And the reason for that is actually relatively simple. Again, if you go back to this picture of I have this material co-rotating as it goes out, as you go out, the centrifugal force gets stronger and stronger. And so the centrifugal force expands the atmosphere of the neutron star and allows you to blow significantly more material off of the surface of the neutron star. And that effectiveness of that is a function, of course, of the magnetic field strength. If I'm rapidly rotating but B is basically zero, okay, then you don't get very much enhancement of the mass loss rate. So that's illustrated here, 10 to the 13, 10 to the 14, 3 by 10 to the 14, 10 to the 15 Gauss. As you go up, the mass loss rate increases, and eventually it saturates, because eventually you're co-rotating, you're fully co-rotating in the region where the mass loss is set. So the standard estimates for the mass loss rate from a non-rotating neutron star actually underestimate the mass loss rate for the problem of interest by a significant factor, at least an order of magnitude, maybe a factor of 20 or 30, depending on exactly what the rotation rate of the neutron star is. And for the magnetic field strengths that matter for spinning down a young neutron star, you're really at these top curves here. So the mass loss rate is 10 to minus 3, 10 to minus 4 solar masses a second in the first few seconds, but it drops very rapidly. The mass loss rate goes roughly like neutrino luminosity to the 2.5 power.
Okay. Can you remind us what's breakup at this time? Is it 7,000?
Breakup, well, so these calculations are for a 10, a radius of 10 kilometers. So then the breakup is 0.6 milliseconds or something. So it's more like 10 or 12,000, I forget. Yeah.
So at
between a second and 2 seconds, the radius is about 12 kilometers in calculations that do the early evolution. So it's, I mean, it's contracted to a reasonable, within 20-30%, I think it's contracted to it. There is a significant amount of mass loss. So at early times, when the neutron star is more inflated, you'll approach something more like these values. And then as you contract, as you rotate faster, field goes up. So I think this is a very good point, is that what happens in the first second or two in particular, which is actually quite interesting because you can lose a lot of energy then, depends on the early cooling evolution. And that might be different than what standard calculations predict in the presence of rapid rotation and strong magnetic fields. So this is a very interesting problem. Okay. So this really sets the scale for how much mass is being blown off the surface of the neutron star. And knowing how much mass is being, I wanted to emphasize that this is actually a strong function of time. So what this is a plot of neutrino luminosity as a function of the rotation rate of the neutron star for a fixed magnetic field strength of about 3 times 10 to the 14 Gauss. And what it just highlights is that where in this parameter space of neutrino luminosity, you can think of that as time as well, early times, late times. Is the outflow non-relativistic? Is it relativistic? Is the mass loss enhanced by this centrifugal flinging? Right, that requires, as you can see, periods of a few milliseconds, 3 milliseconds or so. So it requires periods less than a few milliseconds, you get enhanced mass loss. And as the neutron star cools and the mass loss decreases, the outflow becomes more and more relativistic. You still have this big torque from the neutron star, but the mass loss is going down, so the neutron star is becoming more and more relativistic. And the parameter that characterizes that is called sigma, and it's basically the magnetic field, the magnetic energy divided by the mass loss rate. So you can think of this as a proxy for the Lorentz factor of the outflow. If this is less than one, it's a non-relativistic outflow. If this is bigger than one, the magnetic energy dominates and there's the potential for a highly relativistic outflow.
When you're rapidly rotating, is it really centrifugal flinging that matters in the fact that you've lowered gravity, little g, because if you know, playing parallel, there's dependence of N dot on the neutrino luminosity given just by the local gravitational acceleration.
Right. You enhance the scale height because you reduce the effective gravity. That's one way to think about it. That's right.
I'm trying to ask, though, that's just an effect of the plane parallel neutrino.
You mean with no...
With no magnetic field.
Oh, no, then you don't, then the mass loss is, so if I were to make, that's on the plot. So B goes to zero, what you find is that it's basically flat. There's a little increase that as you approach breakup, then things start to go. Okay. All right. So this is really just to emphasize that this is, the evolution of this wind is a strong function of time. It starts out, as we just discussed, actually the neutron star starts out relatively big and puffy. It's definitely a thermally driven outflow at that time. As the neutron star contracts in the first second or so, you know, maybe 50% slop in that, as the neutron star contracts, the outflow becomes more and more magnetically driven, and then as it cools, it's a magnetically driven relativistic outflow. So, given these mass loss rates, understanding how much material the neutron star loses, we can now think about how the neutron star spins down, and is it really accurate to treat it as a problem in which it's just a vacuum problem? And the answer is no, for two reasons. So first of all, it turns out slightly counterintuitively that when the problem is non-relativistic, okay, the standard pulsar stuff is a fully relativistic problem, when the problem is non-relativistic, the neutron star actually spins down faster. And the spin down time, the rate at which you're losing energy, goes like mass loss rate to the minus 1/3. So as m dot goes up, the spin down time goes down, you lose energy more and more rapidly. And what's happening, it's slightly counterintuitive, as mass loss goes up, this point of co-rotation moves in, which you'd think would make the ability to lose energy less efficient, but the energy you're losing depends on the product of how much mass you're losing and this radius squared, and the answer is that m dot going up wins out over that radius moving in. Okay, at least until you get very close to the surface of a neutron star. So in the early non-relativistic phase, you can actually lose energy substantially more rapidly than the relativistic problem would give you. But there's another effect which is, I think, actually more interesting and more dramatic, and that has to do with Omer's question before, which is that there's actually another radius in the problem. So I specified two radii, light cylinder, point of co-rotation at the speed of light, Alphane radius, point where the magnetic field stops the material from co-rotating. But there's also a point here, which is the radius of the last closed field line. And that's this point right here. So what is this? This is essentially, this is the radius that bounds the region of closed magnetic field. Outside this radius, we have open field lines. Inside this radius, we have closed field lines. Why is this important? This is important because the standard estimates of vacuum dipole spin down that I gave assume that that radius is equal to that radius. They assume that the last closed field line is the light cylinder. Okay. If that is not the case, if the last closed field line is further in, what does it mean? It means the field is more open and it looks more like a monopole than a dipole. But a monopole, as you move out, the field is stronger, so you get a bigger torque. And you get a bigger torque, which is basically the ratio of the light cylinder to the last closed field line squared. And that squared is just b squared. And the difference between a monopole and a dipole is 1 power of r. And so this factor of r squared just comes from the pointing flux, which goes like b squared. Okay, and then the difference between a monopole and a dipole scaling. And in some early analytic work that Todd Thompson and I did on this week, speculated for analytic reasons that in this problem the radius of the last closed field line would be inside the radius of the light cylinder, and that indeed is seen in the two-dimensional general relativistic simulations that Niccolo has done. So these are now simulations where what we've done is we've taken a simple model, no neutrinos, just adiabatic equation of state, and we've adjusted the pressure on the surface of the neutron star such that the mass loss rate is consistent with this calculation. And then we've solved for the multidimensional structure of how the neutron star spins down. And this particular problem is period of a millisecond, b of about 10 to 15 Gauss, and the outflow is pretty relativistic. Okay, you can see that because this Alphane radius is nearly at the light cylinder. And the interesting thing is that this last closed field line is actually well inside the light cylinder by about a factor of 3. And that's true for all of the calculations that we did, from non-relativistic outflows with sigma of about a tenth, even less, to relativistic outflows with sigma of order 20. And I think the most interesting thing here, slightly surprising, interesting, is that even when the outflow is relativistic, you still get this last closed field line being inside the light cylinder. Now, presumably at some point, when the mass loss goes to zero, this radius will move out, but we haven't seen that happen yet. Okay, it's just hard to run these calculations for very relativistic systems.
But Anatoly did.
No, he did a force-free calculation.
But that's the ultimate limit, right?
Sure, but the question is, what requires force-freeness, right? So this is saying, rather interestingly, that even 20, which is much bigger than 1, but certainly much less than infinity, which is the force-free approximation, okay, you still get this enhanced torque. And the reason for this, you can actually understand this analytically, there's a well-known effect in standard stellar wind theory. It's that if you try to construct a hydrostatic solution inside this region, the rapid rotation, if you balance the pressure with the magnetic tension and magnetic pressure, you get the last closed field line well inside the light cylinder because of the effects of rapid rotation.
This, I mean, if you start doing an offset dipole,
yeah.
What's your sense of whether how robust this is?
That's a good question. I haven't thought about that. I'm not going to give a glib answer because I haven't thought about that carefully. No, that's a fair question.
But
you're
really depending on the symmetry fields.
Well, what you're depending on the key is the rapid rotation, which, again, it's the same story. It inflates the pressure in the closed zone.
Here your stagnant point is fixed.
That's right.
It's fixed in location, whereas
that's right.
In the non-aligned, it won't be.
Yes, that's right.
So you wouldn't say hydrostatics if you're not aligned.
Yes, so that's a fair question. So there's also, I'm happy to talk about this, I'm not going to go into it. There's all kinds of cool things. You notice something a little funky at that point. This is a current sheet. You get reconnection. You get things like coronal mass ejections, material being blown out. So there's all kinds of actually interesting variability in this problem because of this current sheet and because it's actually non-trivial to maintain that material. That region wants to open up periodically. So this is the kind of steady state location, but it's actually fluctuating around because of coronal mass ejection. All right, so we now have an estimate for the rate at which you're losing mass. We now know that the torque is substantially enhanced relative to the vacuum dipole problem.
Ridges, feed lines are different bends. How bent are they if you look at this from?
So this gives you that. This is B phi over BR. So B phi over BR is about 1 at the alpha endpoint. So it turns out that the right answer is that the rate of angular momentum loss is equivalent to perfect co-rotation out to the Alphane radius. There isn't actually perfect co-rotation out to the Alphane radius, but just mathematically it's as if that were true. So the field is bent back by order unity at the Alphane radius, which is actually equivalent in the standard vacuum dipole problem. It's bent by order unity at the light cylinder. And so you can see that here, right? In this region, it's bent much less. All right, so we have the ingredients now. We know m dot, we know e dot, we know how e dot is modified by m dot. So we can calculate evolutionary calculations for the rate at which the neutron star loses energy. And these are just a couple of examples. You give me a b and an omega, and I can do the calculation, or Brian can do the calculation. So this shows e dot as a function of time since core collapse. Sigma as a function of time since core collapse, where this tells you how relativistic it is. These are for millisecond rotators, 10 to the 16, 3 by 10 to the 15, 10 to the 15 Gauss. You get whopping energy loss rates, 10 to the 51, 10 to the 52 ergs a second, okay, on second time scale. So as we've already discussed, you know, I think the things are the most uncertain at the origin of time, because that depends on exactly how the neutron star is contracting in that very early phase. But what this shows is these enhancements to the energy loss rate can increase the rate at which you lose energy relative to the vacuum dipole prediction by at least an order of magnitude, and maybe a factor of 30 or 100.
Excuse me.
Yep.
It escapes me. What's the fundamental, what's the physical problem that prevents you to make short jumps?
The star. The star. So if accretion-induced collapse, this is perfect for a short GRB. But the problem is getting out of the star. It's not clear you can blow through the star in the relevant time scale for tens or 30 milliseconds. So I think where things could be more interesting is if I have accretion-induced collapse of a white dwarf to a neutron star. I'm rapidly rotating, I form a protoneutron star with a whopping big magnetic field. There, I think there's no doubt that I'm going to end up with a millisecond magnetar. The question is just, does it actually happen? Okay. So I think in that case, that's a very interesting possibility. So
this is not in your calculation.
What is not? The star?
The star.
Hold on just a second. We'll get to the star in just a second.
But not so far, right?
No.
You're showing something that...
Right. So that's the assumption. Right now, the supernova shock is moving out, and this thing is just about to slam into that outgoing supernova shock. Exactly. So you get very rapid energy loss, and the generic evolution is that it goes from non-relativistic to relativistic as a function of time, as the neutrino luminosity goes away. And that transition from non-relativistic to relativistic is relatively quick. It happens on a few second time scales. And on time scales of 5 to 10 seconds, you have magnetizations of 130,000, exactly what you need to produce gamma ray bursts. So you get, I would say, you get for free, okay, given B and omega, you get the time scale right, the energy scale right, and the Lorentz factor magnetization scale right. Okay. And one interesting point is that you can actually extract, you may be able to extract energy so efficiently that you, on a time scale relevant for things like nickel nucleosynthesis, you actually impart huge amounts of energy to the outgoing shock, and you can affect the early time nucleosynthesis. That has to happen in the first second or two. Okay, so the temperatures of the shock are high enough to process material up to nickel, so it's sensitive to this complication of early time spin down. But these calculations give so much energy coming out at early times that it's actually a very interesting problem for modifying the nucleosynthesis of the outgoing shock. So, as I said, we can do this calculation for a wide range of magnetic field strengths and rotation periods. So this is just a plot to illustrate. This is the energy extracted from the neutron star in the Kelvin-Helmholtz time, first 4,000 seconds, as a function of the birth period, the initial period of the neutron star, and the magnetic field strength. And all I want to illustrate here is that, you know, the birth of neutron stars is a multidimensional parameter space of B and omega, and in that parameter space, in that corner, you get conditions that are very interesting for producing hyperenergetic supernovae and GRBs. That's the few millisecond, 10 to the 15 Gauss part of parameter space. In more modestly rotating, more modest magnetic field, there's not a huge amount of energy on the scale of the neutron, of the supernova shock. Okay, the energy scale is more like 10 to the 50 ergs, but it's collimated, and so the energy per unit solid angle along the pole is comparable to that in the supernovae, so you can modify the structure of the supernova, make an asymmetric ejecta. Okay, this would be a non-relativistic outflow, but asymmetric. And then if you're down here at longer rotation periods, lower B field, it's a standard protoneutron star that doesn't have really any impact on its surrounding supernova shock. The energy is just insufficient for a 10 millisecond, 5 millisecond rotator to do anything.
The collimation that you mentioned is the same as Bucciantini.
The collimation in this case is just non-relativistic outflows collimate. It's a non-relativistic outflow. Right? Getting non-relativistic, they collimate, you know, by hoop stress. All right. So the last thing I want to mention, which I think is very important, is the issue of how do you get collimation for the relativistic outflow? So there's two motivations for this problem. Let me give you the empirical one first and then the theoretical one. So the empirical motivation is the following. The isotropic, now that we know that long-duration gamma ray bursts are cosmological, the isotropic energy emitted in gamma rays is really big, 10 to the 53, 10 to the 54 ergs. That's much more than the energy scale I'm talking about. Empirically, there's evidence that gamma ray bursts are collimated. There's been a lot of discussion in the literature about using breaks in afterglow light curves to infer how collimated things are. I think a fair statement is that that interpretation has become complicated by swift observations that don't seem to show, in the first 10 days or so, evidence for breaks from X-ray afterglows, as illustrated by this title, by a recent paper by Burroughs that summarizes this. Nonetheless, even though this interpretation of afterglows is complicated, so we shouldn't believe the energy scale that Frail and Cole Carney told us for gamma ray bursts necessarily, we know that there is collimation. And we know that from late time radio observations, which are basically, things are non-relativistic at late times. It's a spherical problem. We can probe by Sedov-Taylor arguments the total energy in the explosion. And this is work a number of people have done. This has been done only for a few bursts, but that gives an energy scale in the initial explosion of 10 to the 51 or 10 to the 52 ergs. So there is significant collimation. The interpretation of breaks, complicated, that we're not sure what that's telling us, but the late time stuff, to my mind, is pretty straightforward. That's a Sedov-Taylor blast wave, non-relativistic, no beaming to speak of, and so we can compare that energy to that energy and we find out that things are collimated. So that's the observational motivation that we need for gamma ray bursts to get collimated material coming out, relativistic material coming out collimated. The theoretical problem is relatively straightforward. If I put off a bunch of relativistic hot, you know, this outgoing relativistic plasma inside a star, and I try to push it out spherically through 10 solar masses of material, I'm not going to get a relativistic outflow at large radii. I'm trying to go through too much mass. I need to somehow blow my way through that mass to allow my relativistic material to escape. So how do I do that? The problem, the theoretical problem, is the following. It's been well known for a long time that relativistic, ideal, meaning no dissipation, ideal relativistic MHD outflows do not self-collimate. This story about magnetic field winding and hoop stress doesn't work in the relativistic limit. It's very inefficient. In fact, in relativistic winds, and this is illustrated in one of the simulations that Niccolo did, which shows these are the field lines, the poloidal field lines coming off the surface. This is 100 neutron star radii. We've gone out to 1,000 neutron star radii, and there's very little evidence for collimation. And there's progressively less evidence for collimation as you make things relativistic. When they're non-relativistic, it does collimate. So in fact, in the relativistic wind problem, this is incidentally a problem for jets from accreting black holes too. We just know empirically that those produce jets, but it's not entirely obvious theoretically how that happens still. So the energy flux in this problem is actually in the relativistic limit, mostly comes out in the equator. So how might we get collimation in this problem? Well, there are some interesting clues from observations of the Crab Nebula and other pulsar wind nebulae. So these are two images of the Crab. This is the X-ray image in the central region, and this is if I remember, yeah, this is a VLT image, I believe. This is the synchrotron nebula, and this is the supernova ejecta. Okay. So there's two things you'll notice about that. One is that on the inside, the synchrotron emission from the Crab Nebula shows two components. It shows a torus in the equator, and it shows a jet along the pole. The jet is, it looks, okay, there's some maybe evidence there for a jet. There's something there. It's not, if you believe this feature, then you would say this is not incredibly asymmetric, meaning it can't be very relativistic because it's not very beamed. Okay. In fact, the interpretation of this jet is that what's happening is that the material is coming out mostly in the equator, then it shocks, it runs into ejecta, it shocks, it becomes a relativistic thermal plasma. So it's not now moving relativistically, but it's relativistically hot. When it's not moving relativistically, the magnetic field can now collimate it. And so it collimates some fraction of the material now into a relativistic outflow along the pole. So the key is the interaction between the ejecta and the outgoing supernova ejecta. So my model or my argument is that maybe the same thing happens in the supernova GRB problem. That to understand the collimation, you have to think about the interaction between the central source and the outgoing supernova shock. And so this is my sophisticated theoretical model for that. We have a central source, which is the magnetar spinning down, a souped-up Crab Nebula, and we have an outgoing supernova shock. So what happens? This ejecta runs into the surrounding supernova shock. It shocks. It becomes non-relativistic, but very hot. So you have a relativistically hot plasma bottled up inside the star. If this ejecta is moving out at a speed significantly less than the speed of light, then this plasma inside here reaches hydrostatic equilibrium, or magnetohydrostatic equilibrium. Okay, and there's actually a beautiful solution. This is a really one of those papers I wish I had written, but I was too young, by Begelman and Lee in the early 90s. They solved for the equilibrium structure of plasma, okay, in magnetohydrostatic equilibrium when the field is mostly toroidal, phi, which is what you expect at large distances in the wind. And this is slightly complicated. I should have made a better plot. What this shows is the total pressure as a function of radius, cylindrical radius, divided by a characteristic scale height of the problem, and I'll define that in a second. So what is this scale height? Well, the way to think about this is that if B goes to zero, then it's a spherical problem. The scale height goes to infinity, and so for any finite radius in the nebula, you're at this point where the pressure is constant as a function of radius because it's spherical. But if B is very strong, this collimating effect of the magnetic field is important. This scale height H gets small, and so for a finite radius of the bubble, R over H is big, and so the pressure is much bigger along the axis than it is near the equator. And so this system wants to evolve not going spherically if B is big, but by going out along the poles. And so we've done some calculations to show that explicitly. What we've done is we've taken a supernova progenitor model from Hager and Woosley, 30 solar mass, it actually doesn't matter that much what progenitor you've used. Take a progenitor star, put inside it this bubble of relativistic plasma and magnetic field, and solve for the evolution of the bubble. And the way this is done is using the thin shell equations, which is kind of analogous to set off Taylor blast waves, except it's a two-dimensional problem. So you have something pushing on the inside, which is this asymmetric bubble, and you have a star on the outside. And here's the solution. You take the energy injection rate from some of those evolutionary calculations of magnetar spin down I showed you. You put it off into a progenitor. If you're injecting primarily thermal energy, so it's not a very magnetized outflow, then the pressure is relatively isotropic. And so the system, these are as a function of time, 1 second after the explosion, up to 10 seconds. This shows the evolution of the supernova shock in this two-dimensional problem now, and it's relatively spherical. There's a little bit of asymmetry, but it's not that asymmetric. So this would be a situation where you'd put in all of this energy in relativistic plasma, 10 to the 52 ergs, but it's not going to blow out the polar region, it's just going to blow up the star relatively spherically, giving you a hyperenergetic supernova, but not all that much relativistic material. So now increase how much magnetic field there is, how magnetized the outflow is, and the system becomes more asymmetric. Okay. Increase it again, becomes more asymmetric, and have about half or so of the energy coming out in the magnetic field, and you get a very asymmetric nebula. So this is the initial time, and then at later times, you notice because the pressure pushes along the axis, the thing just blows up along the axis. It doesn't actually, it's not moving very fast along the equatorial region because the pressure there is much lower. So now you've created a big channel for all of this relativistic plasma to escape, and you can actually get a GRB. All right, so which of these is actually realized? Well, the answer, unfortunately, is that I don't know. And the problem is, for those of you who know a lot about relativistic outflows, this is related to the so-called sigma problem, which is that it's very hard to calculate exactly at large radii how much energy is still in the magnetic field relative to the plasma. And this is something we're trying to do, but this is a hard calculation. It's a long outstanding problem. So at this point, all I can say is that it's clear, depending on how the central magnetar interacts with its host star and how magnetized the nebula it creates is, you can get hyperenergetic supernovae or GRBs, but I'm not going to argue, I can't argue convincingly that it's one or the other. My suspicion, or my hope, is that this actually partially represents an evolutionary sequence, that at early times it's a more mass-loaded problem and it'll look more like this, so it'll expand more spherically. At late times it becomes more and more relativistic, more magnetized, and it'll look more like this.
How do you actually
get both? That's just what I said. My hope is that it transitions from this to this as a function of time. As you go from very mass loaded, it's relatively spherical, and then this is really, this should be viewed, this is the first 3 seconds, and this is, as later times, it becomes more and more asymmetric. But that's exactly the right question. I agree. That's the very interesting question. The other thing, of course, is that this particular calculation starts off spherical. Okay, if I ask Adam Burrows and look at his simulation, that simulation is not spherical. The explosion itself is asymmetric. And so I think there's an interesting question of doing this right requires understanding the interaction of the wind at 10 seconds with the explosion at 1 second, which may already be asymmetric. And if it's already asymmetric at 1 second, that makes it easier for the system to evolve into this situation. But these are all very interesting questions about exactly can you get both, or is it one or the other in this particular picture? That depends, I think, on better modeling this interaction. So this is just, you know, illustrating, I think, the reasonable range of possibilities, and we need to understand better what's going on. All right, so I'll just leave the summary up there. I mentioned there's a couple things I didn't talk about having to do with nucleus synthesis in these outflows, which may be interesting. I'd be happy to talk to people about that. Thanks.
So you try the third-type solar mass
editor.
What happens if you change the mass?
So what happens is that if I take, say, a 20 solar mass, 11 solar mass progenitor, or something like that, and I fix the rate at which I'm putting energy.
By that main sequence?
Yeah, that's the, okay. Yeah, that's right. Then if I have a lower mass progenitor, I have a lower mass at the end of the day, there's less inertia on the outside, this process happens more quickly. Okay. So it's basically, you know, it depends on how much inertia there is confining. I mean, this is a really, this is a very interesting problem, right? Because what you're doing is you're using the confinement to make it asymmetric. And if there's less confinement, less inertia out there, then this whole process happens more quickly. Okay, but actually, qualitatively, which is, you know, I view this as a very useful semi-quantitative calculation to shape our thinking about what might happen. So at that level, there's really no strong dependence on the progenitor.
Related question, but I'll ask anyway. First of all, there are few magnetars, and there are lots of gamma ray bursts, including many, many long ones.
Right.
So the statistics don't quite.
Well, no, the statistics are that the estimate of the there are few magnetars because they spend very little time shining as magnetars. They spin down very quickly. They don't spend time when you can see them as a magnetar. So the birth rate estimate is that the birth rate of magnetars is 10% of neutron stars. That's the rough estimate, which is much bigger than the rate of hyperenergetic supernovae or GRBs. So I would say this has to actually be a relatively rare, it's the other way around, this has to be a rare class of magnetars that does this. And you know, remember, there's a huge difference here between 3 millisecond birth period and 1 millisecond birth period. That's kind of all the difference, I think, between a big whopping GRB and something that's significantly less energetic that we couldn't have seen now but may see in the future, right? If there's a continuous distribution of birth spin periods, then we should eventually see lower power, longer duration events.
The other question, would it not be possible to test your model if a neutrino birth was actually detected from a GRB? Would it not give it?
If you see coincident with the GRB, the Kelvin-Helmholtz spin down, so actually, and I'll make the prediction now, the prediction is that the neutrino luminosity will be a little bit less and the Kelvin-Helmholtz time will be a little bit longer than the standard predictions. And the reason for that is you have a rotationally supported neutron star, your temperatures are lower, the neutrino luminosity is lower, the energy of the neutrinos is a little bit lower, but absolutely. But that would be great, but we'll, yeah, that would be great.
The neutrino coin in the first second may depend on the equation state and may depend on the mass of the neutron star, for example.
Yeah.
I'm sure about that. Are there any interesting...
So I think there are lots of interesting things to do to understand that the neutrino cooling. So what we've done here is taken Pons's work on neutrino cooling, standard neutrino cooling of neutron stars. But, you know, I think the issues of what happens in the presence of rapid rotation, strong fields, mass of the neutron, I mean, these are interesting questions. I mean, I'm personally, I think the biggest effect is probably, you know, what happens as a depending on the rotation of the neutron star and the B field. So what What I can say is Todd and I did some one-dimensional calculations where, you know, these are again just toy models to inform your thinking, where you take in one dimension, you do a rotating collapse, so it's kind of like the equatorial plane. And what we found there is that the neutrino luminosity at, you know, 700 milliseconds, which is when we stop things, was 50% lower than the standard calculations. And that's because of the rotational support. And that's where this argument about extending the Kelvin-Helmholtz time and decreasing that comes from. But no, I think this is, and I think that's actually critical to understanding these first few seconds, is understanding that better.
From observations, it seems that from this soft gamma ray repeaters, it seems they are related in our galaxy, at least with very massive stars. I mean, they found a couple of
new stars. Yeah, that's right. That's right.
Now, also, observationally, it looks like the long gamma ray bursts are associated also with collapses of very massive.
Yes.
Could you find a reason why you would just have these strong magnetic fields if the star is so massive?
Right. So that's a, I don't have an answer. I mean, that's a very interesting question. It's the pre-supernova evolution. You know, I think the best work on this is the work that motivated by some calculations Hank Spruit did, that Hager and Woosley did, including trying to include the effects of magnetic field on the rotational evolution of massive stars prior to core collapse. My personal feeling is that we don't understand how to redistribute angular momentum in stars well enough to believe those calculations for the kind of question you're answering.
Yeah,
it's just a very...
The observations of magnetons...
Yeah,
of
no, that's a very...
Gamma ray bursts all indicate very massive stars.
Right, so I that's an interesting question. I don't have a good answer for that.
Actually, more of a comment. You mentioned sort of the one observational slide. There's some doubt now whether there are breaks in reverse based on script observations, and I think that that still remains to be determined.
We, okay.
A few recent bursts have shown standard optical
breaks.
So
okay.
So, in fact, there was one in January that the script claims does not see a break, but had a very clear optical break, and then a Chandra observation also showed that it had a break in the X-ray, so
okay.
Things may
okay.
be a little funny.
No, so I mean, so I agree. I think they're collimated. They're clearly collimated. You know, some of the a few of the early cases were beautiful and achromatic, and it seemed, you know, pre-Swift, right? It seemed clear that this was consistent with the break that you expected. I think the only worry is that in cases where it wasn't all that achromatic, or you only had a couple of wavelengths, was could it be that there was over-interpretation, that maybe the breaks were due to something else? But.
I think Swift is just kind of a small telescope, and you get down.
You just think it's missing it by...
The top, you can sometimes
miss
the breaks.
Okay. So you actually saw it with Chandra when Swift didn't see it?
There was an observation, a late observation with Chandra that was consistent with the optical break.
Okay.
But the Swift people said that there was no break.
Okay. So, no, that's interesting.
I presume it's really difficult to find a distinctive signature in the observation.
Right.
Right. So what would be, which suggested, I mean, for example, do you have a reason to think that these things could be softer events than the standard collapse?
Right. So that's obviously a very, very good question, something we've worried about a lot. And so one of the things we've thought about in terms of trying to come up with a unique signature is trying to understand things like nucleosynthesis in the outflow. Can you get some signature from that? In terms of the actual signature for the GRB itself, I think the concern I have is that it's very unclear how to go from this plot to a gamma ray light curve and a gamma ray temperature. And Brian, who's very bold, my student who's very good and very bold, has done some preliminary calculations, for example, this gives you a Lorentz factor as a function of time, so you can try to do a standard internal shock story to predict the spectrum, the efficiency of producing. This is a rapidly evolving gamma as a function of time. You get very high efficiencies of internal shocks, 20, 30, 40%. You can try to predict the spectrum. But then my concern, the reason I'm not sure I actually believe any of that, is that, you know, that's a very particular way of relating this central engine physics to how it manifests itself observationally. And I think we don't understand how to make that connection well enough. So I would like to be able to say that there is a unique signature to go from this to the observations, meaning specifically the gamma ray burst observations. But I think that's hard to do at this time.
Well, it is interesting in that context that the only time we have indirect evidence from nucleosynthesis is probably a neutron star remnant. We see an X-ray flash rather than GFP, and we don't see a variant spherical supernova.
You don't, sorry, what was the last? You don't see a variant
spherical supernova.
Okay. Which?
It's 06 HA.
Okay. Okay.
Considering the fraction of magnetons of the Langer V,
right,
and comparing that with the Langer V rate, is
yep.
it consistent at all?
Can
you determine which, how, what fraction
so, of magnetons? So if you give me the distribution of B and omega at birth, I can give you that, I can answer that question. But I don't know how to calculate that distribution of B and omega at birth. I mean, this is the answer to that question. If I convolve this with a birth period and magnetic field distribution, I can answer that, but I have no idea how to do that. I don't have those initial conditions to do that convolution. The argument now is that the rates of magnetars are much bigger than, the rate of magnetar birth is much bigger than the GRB birth, so you just need a small fraction up in that parameter space to do the job, but calculating that small fraction is not possible.
I have actually quite a few questions. First, getting back to Elena's earlier question,
yeah.
the short duration.
Yeah.
I think she was asking how you measure a time scale that seems to be seconds.
Not right. Seconds. Right. That's right. So the way, I mean, it all depends on B and omega. If I have a sufficient, if accretion-induced collapse produces, which may produce the most rapidly rotating neutron stars with the strongest magnetic fields, it could give you yet shorter time scales. But that's...
What's different in your
calculation? Oh, it would just be in this, right, in the very high B rapid rotation limit, you can extract 10 to the 51, 10 to the 52 ergs in 100 milliseconds. But that depends crucially on what's happening at very early time. So I'm not particularly advocating that.
On the issue of the progenitors, I think the models by Heger probably don't produce the right progenitors, would be my guess. I mean, at least when the magnetic fields are included.
Yes, so that's, so when they, I have part of that somewhere. Maybe not. Well, anyway, I agree. I agree.
What about some progenitors in our galaxy? I want to ask about two specific objects. One is the neutron star NGSA, and the other one, the neutron star 87A.
Yeah.
Both of these be magnetars?
I don't think they could be very rapidly rotating magnetars.
So they don't have to be gamma ray burst.
Fine, yeah. I think if it were, so the constraint is that it would have to be sufficiently slowly rotating, but it doesn't.
Which is what we'd expect for 87.
Yeah. So that, I haven't, the honest answer is I haven't thought about that.
Really, is it possible that it was actually very relatively rapidly spinning and had a lot of energy output early on, but could now be basically undetectable because the limits on 87A now. As far as the energy input in the remnant
yes.
are very low.
Right. So that's a very interesting question. Namely, if one were to take one of these progenitor models, evolve it forward, you know, tens of years, what would it predict for the current EDOT? And so I don't know the answer to that.
Great. Thanks, Elliot.
Lunch? Yeah, I'm good.